Election Day is less than 2 weeks away. Do you know where your candidate's money is coming from? This year, more of it is coming from the marijuana industry.
We've been making contributes for years, but we are really ramping it up now because we are seeing more public support and more movements at every level of government than ever before.
I'm Mark Brody.
I'm Steve Goldstein. Also on the show, the Navajo Supreme Court orders the tribe's presidential election be postponed.
Arizona voters will decide again whether state lawmakers get a raise.
And how much money do Arizonans get from the feds?
That's the message we're really trying to get across with this website, is the way that the government actually affects real people.
Plus, we'll go out to the ballpark and take a spin in a gently used truck, a million miles in an AM radio.
That and more on the show.
Thursday edition.
After a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. No need to check your calendar. We're now on Thursdays and Fridays. Valley weather for tonight. Look for clear skies and lows in the mid to upper 60s. For tomorrow, we'll warm up a little bit more. Sunny skies with a high of 96. It's currently mostly sunny and 91. Quickly in Valley traffic, one troublesome accident. It's I-17 southbound at Cactus.
The first case of enterovirus has been confirmed in Arizona. The child, who's from Maricopa County, was hospitalized, has since recovered and been released. So now that EVD68 is here, what's next? KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports on what this news means to the parents of children and infants who could be at risk.
It was only a matter of time. Arizona, along with just a few other states, had yet to report any confirmed cases of enterovirus D68, the respiratory illness affecting young children and infants, particularly those with asthma. That changed Wednesday.
We are sending tests to CDC every day for suspect enterovirus D68 cases, and tests are coming back on a daily basis. So far, this has been the first confirmed positive test, and we will likely see more in the future.
That's Dr. Rebecca Sonnenschein. She's with the Disease Control Division at the Maricopa County Department of Public Health. Sonnenschein couldn't talk about the specifics of how the child contracted EVD68. It's that vagueness that makes the virus especially frightening to many parents. Sonnenschein understands why parents are fearful. She's the mother of a young child with asthma, but she's also mindful of the realities.
Influenza causes approximately 24,000 deaths per year. And there have only been a small number of deaths from enterovirus D68.
Enterovirus D68 isn't new, though according to Sonnenschein, this is the first case in recent memory to hit Arizona. There's also no vaccine. Sonnenschein advises parents and teachers to remind kids to wash their hands and cover their coughs and sneezes. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News.
The Navajo Supreme Court today ordered the tribe's presidential election be postponed. That comes after one of the candidates, Chris Deschini, was disqualified because he's not fluent in Navajo. Joining us now to sort out what's happened and what it means is KJZZ's Laurel Morales. Hi, Laurel.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. And so if we know the election won't be held on November 4th as planned, we know things are changing rapidly. What can you tell us about what the situation is right now?
So right now, they've dropped Chris Deschini from the ballot. The Navajo Supreme Court has ordered Chris Deschini's name off the ballot and to move up the third place primary finisher, that's Russell Begay, and to send out new ballots.
Do we know what will happen to the ballots that have already been sent out and maybe filled out and not returned and those that have been returned already?
It's a great question, and everyone is wondering that as well. What we do know is that those who voted in the presidential election, those on those early ballots, those will likely be tossed out. But things are changing moment to moment.
This turnout obviously can affect other races, perhaps most notably in the congressional district number one, where Ann Kirkpatrick is trying to defend her seat against Andy Tobin. How might this decision impact that race?
So if voters do not go to the polls on November 4th, this could have a major impact on especially Ann Kirkpatrick. She's counting on those votes. One in four of every one of her votes in the last election were Native American.
Laurel, final sort of two-part question looking forward. One, does Chris Deschini have any more legal recourse? And part two of that, this has been kind of an emotional upheaval among people who are for Deschini, not for Deschini, the fight over being fluent in Navajo. Is this something that could be a dividing point going forward? Is this something where wounds will need to be healed?
So right now, the Navajo Council is deciding whether to eliminate this fluency requirement or change it. They're deciding that today, and it's an emergency legislation with the hopes of possibly saving this election or keeping Chris Descheny on the ballot, I should say. There are a lot of people that understand why he doesn't speak fluently and can relate. Descheny himself blames what he calls cultural destruction and the federal boarding schools that up until the 60s sent Native people from all over the country to these boarding schools where they were forced to speak only English and not practice any of their culture.
KJZZ's Laurel Morales. Laurel, thanks.
You're welcome.
Throughout the election season, lots of groups have given lots of money to lots of candidates. But those groups supporting legalization of marijuana are starting to give a little more than they have in the past.
The Marijuana Policy Project, for example, has so far given more than $60,000 this cycle, including to two candidates in Arizona. The group's communications director, Mason Tavert, says it plans to dole out nearly $150,000 this year. That's compared to about $110,000 last year. Tavert says the PAC supports candidates who've been out front on marijuana policy issues.
Our PAC has contributed to state and federal candidates who are interested in working to end prohibition in the United States and are willing to speak up in support of that change.
What led you to donate to a member of Arizona's congressional delegation and a candidate for Congress here in Arizona?
Congressman Grijalva and Representative Gallego have been very outspoken in their support for more sensible marijuana policies, and we want to support those candidates who support changing marijuana laws for the better.
Do you expect prohibitions to end by way of congressional action, or as they have so far, where they have is in terms of voter mandates?
Right now, it appears that we're going to continue to see change taking place at the state level all around the country, and the federal government will continue to move and discuss this issue. Right now, we don't see Congress really addressing much of anything, let alone marijuana policy. So states will continue to adopt regulatory systems for adult use and medical marijuana, but we also will sooner or later need to see change at the federal level as well.
Well, so I guess given the fact that, as you said, that at least in the near future, most likely any change that happens will come from the state level, why give to members of Congress when Congress, as you also pointed out, isn't really doing much of anything, much less marijuana policy?
Well, Congress is working on a number of issues. You can't be completely absent. You know, there have been a number of bills introduced to improve our federal marijuana laws, and it's not just a matter of making marijuana legal at the federal level. There are also issues like banking and tax issues that are really important when it comes to states being able to implement their laws effectively.
Is the fact that your organization is able to make political donations like this a sign of the evolution of the marijuana industry?
We've been making contributes for years, but we are really ramping it up now because we are seeing more public support and more movement at every level of government than ever before.
Mason Tavert is the communications director for the Marijuana Policy Project. The group has donated to incumbent Congressman Raul Grijalva, as well as to Democratic candidate Ruben Gallego, who says marijuana policy should be similar to that for alcohol.
It should be taxed, regulated, and sold to people above the age of 21. So we create a market that is not controlled by the black market.
So given that, does it make sense to you why some of these groups would be contributing to your congressional campaign then?
Well, I think also a lot of it goes back to just my early advocacy for legalization and regulation of marijuana. I introduced a bill last year, even prior to running for Congress, where I have been a strong advocate for it, as well as just a strong supporter of the Medical Marijuana Act.
Do you consider accepting donations from groups like the Marijuana Policy Project and the National Cannabis Industry Association to be basically like any other industry group that's supporting a congressional candidate?
Yeah, because, you know, like many other organizations, these are legitimate businessmen that are pulling their money and really pulling their interests, as well as informing a lot of elected officials about some of the restrictions, as well as some of the positives of their industry. And, you know, for like-minded people that believe that marijuana should be legalized, Marijuana Policy Project is one of the organizations that you should work through.
What kind of actions, if any, do you expect Congress might be taking on this issue in the next year or two?
Well, I think what we're going to be looking at is mostly on the banking side. Right now, it's very difficult for a lot of legitimate businesses that are involved in marijuana sales or growth for them to safely put their money in banks. There are some old laws that make it difficult for a lot of these businesses to actually bank like any other normal business organization. That causes a lot of security risk because many of these businesses are holding huge cash reserves. So I think that's one thing that's going to be tackled. And two, a lot of these businesses also do investments into their business but aren't allowed to deduct a lot of their costs to their business. And I think that will be another area that will be worked on at the national level.
Ruben Gallego is the Democratic nominee for Congress in Arizona's 7th District.
Still to come, people applying for jobs with the city of Tucson now have one fewer question to answer, and it's a big one.
No longer will there be on the front page of the application a question about your criminal record. And then only for certain jobs will that information be required at all.
Tucson bans the box. That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. Valley weather for tonight should be clear, with overnight lows in the mid to upper 60s. For tomorrow, we're expecting sunny skies with a high of 96, but by early next week, high temperatures should be in the mid-80s. Currently, relative humidity is at 21%. We're showing clear skies and 91 degrees. If you're on I-17, watch out for a couple of accidents, one at State Route 74 and also southbound at Cactus Road.
KJZZ is supported by MidFirst Private Bank, offering private banking, wealth and investment management, and trust services. More information at midfirstprivatebank.com. Member FDIC.
Tucson is changing its job applications. The city is removing the question about a candidate's criminal history. Martha Durkin, Tucson's interim city manager, says she was approached about a national program called Ban the Box, which aims to make it easier for some former offenders to get jobs, and found the argument to use the program very persuasive.
Mostly because of the number of people that do have criminal records and the fact that so many of the screening processes used here at the city and certainly many employers didn't take into account the age of the offense, the nature of the offense, or even how it's related to the job.
So what has changed now for folks applying for jobs with the city of Tucson?
Well, no longer will there be on the front page of the application a question about your criminal record. And then only for certain jobs will that information be required at all. So we've identified the positions in the city that require a background check. For those positions, the announcement for the job will indicate that.
Which jobs will require a background check?
There's going to be quite a long list, but in general, it's any public safety, money handling, sensitive data, access to sensitive data, and children.
Will the presence of a criminal history disqualify a candidate for some or all of those jobs?
It could. If it were a conviction that is related in some way or an indication of an unsafe behavior. Again, it depends on the age of the offense. If it's many years old and the person has an excellent work history, it might not.
Is that similar to how it's done now, just with the difference that the question is asked on the front end, do you have a criminal history?
It's similar, but because people can access public records on criminal convictions so easily, it's become more problematic for the applicant and even for the employer who's trying to read these records. So we believe we may have been keeping people out of the workplace without good cause. The other part of this program, an important one, is notifying a qualified applicant if the applicant was disqualified based on a background check and giving that person an opportunity to refute that.
Have you heard from folks who work either at City Hall or work with other city agencies who are concerned about potentially working with folks who have a criminal history that maybe the city doesn't know about?
No, But I can tell you probably many of us work with people with criminal histories that we don't know about.
Do you think that this is going to greatly enhance the pool of applicants for city jobs?
I think it could provide more applicants, but I think the more important thing it does is give those who have finished their sentence and their probation and are ready to enter the workforce an opportunity to apply on their merits without the chilling effect of that question having to be answered for every job.
Martha Durkin is Tucson's interim city manager. She says the city has already removed the question about criminal history from applications. She expects to have the complete list of jobs which require background checks and the process for applicants to question their disqualification by the start of the new year. The group that went to Durkin is the Phoenix-based William E. Morris Institute for Justice. Its director, Ellen Katz, says the group has also approached Maricopa and Pima counties and the city of Phoenix. But she says Tucson is the first municipality in the state to adopt the program.
This is a movement that is saying, don't ask about criminal history on the face of the application, because the research shows that people who disclose criminal history on the face of their application don't get calls for interviews and don't get hired. So Ban the Box was started to exclude that question from employment applications. And it doesn't mean that the employer won't ask the question at some point, but they will ask it after they found out, you know, about the person's employment record, their education, when that question and its impact will probably be less.
Doesn't that potentially cost an employer time and money, though, if they're looking at somebody and maybe even potentially hiring somebody, and then at the end of the process, they find out, oh, I'm not sure I really want that person in this position because of their history, when they could have found that out right at the beginning?
Well, in fact, that's not what the evidence shows. And just so that you know, there are 13 states that have already banned the box, 70 cities and counties. And no one has gone back. Everyone who has banned the box, what they have done is they've either continued their policies or they've expanded them to private entities or vendors or whatever.
Is there evidence that suggests that by allowing some of these former offenders to get jobs again, that might actually improve things in the criminal justice system?
Well, there's research out of Chicago and a few other places where they track persons, and they have found that, you know, if ex-offenders get out of prison and they don't have employment opportunities, there is a higher chance of them reoffending, and that ex-offenders who have employment have less of a percentage chance of offending again. And so if you have less people offending, obviously you have less prison costs, county jail costs. There's been a study in Philadelphia about, you know, it's a win-win for everybody. What the city or state will get in revenues from taxes, what the people make from a salary, and then what the reduced costs for the prison are.
Ellen Katz is the director of the William E. Morris Institute for Justice.
One of the items on this year's ballot is Proposition 304, which would raise the salary for Arizona's legislators from $24,000 a year to $35,000 a year. Supporters say it's a fair increase considering the many responsibilities of state lawmakers, but as KJZZ's Nick Blumberg reports, similar efforts have not been successful in the past.
The last time Arizona voters approved a pay hike was in 1998. Since then, raises have been voted down in 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006, and 2008.
It sounds like we're on our way to a cheer. 2468, who do you appreciate? Your legislators.
Lisa Atkins chairs the state's Commission on Salaries for Elective State Officers. Every 2 years, the commission is required to review salaries for members of the state House and Senate, statewide elected officials like the governor and the judicial branch, and decide whether to refer a raise to the ballot. Atkins says the commission calculated what the $24,000 salary approved in 1998 would be in today's money. If voters approved the proposition, lawmakers will get an $11,000 pay bump to make up for inflation.
No public official runs because of the salary of the office. Every one of our 90 legislators run because they have a passion about public service and they have a great deal of interest in public policy. But we're asking a lot from them.
Even though the legislature is only supposed to meet for 100 days, it has a way of dragging on. Factor in special sessions and other responsibilities throughout the year, and Atkins says Arizona's is a part-time legislature in name only. But in an election year, the lawmakers themselves may not support the raise.
I think it's absolutely wrong and unmerited and unearned, and it should not pass.
Bruce Wheeler is a Democrat who represents Legislative District 10 in the Tucson area. Last year, Wheeler was involved with a bill that would have raised per diem payments to legislators before withdrawing his support.
People in Arizona, many, are hurting much more than any member of the state House of Representatives or the state Senate. So first, we have to improve our economy and earn a pay raise.
But if legislator pay is higher, could it make the pool of candidates interested in running more diverse? Morgan Cullen is with the National Conference of State Legislatures, or the NCSL, and he tracks legislator pay around the country. Arizona is what the NCSL calls a hybrid legislature, not full-time, but with too many responsibilities to be considered truly part-time. Cullen says,
the average salary for those hybrids is a little over $43,000 a year. So they're making decidedly less income among their counterparts.
He says in states with low salaries like Arizona's, many lawmakers are retirees or independently wealthy business owners who can afford to run.
You want those independently wealthy people, you want the retirees, but you also want people in their income earning years as well, so that you are, you know, representing the population as a whole.
But it's not clear whether a pay bump would change the candidate pool. And two members of Arizona's Commission on Legislator Pay opposed this year's proposition. In a statement to voters, former lawmaker Karen Johnson argued that election to the legislature isn't employment and shouldn't be treated as such, and that, quote, bigger salaries will only give us bigger government, not better statesmen. But Commission Chair Lisa Atkins disagrees.
While I know it's popular to wage a war on public spending, if we're going to elect people to do a job, we need to make sure that they're fairly compensated.
There isn't any polling available to see how voters are leaning. Atkins is hopeful, but is managing her expectations based on the many failed attempts at a pay raise in the past. Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Women in the workplace, whether they're experienced business people or just getting started, still face huge challenges. So what if there was a co-working space just for females that could help women succeed? That's a significant part of Lynn King Smith's vision for a 2,000-square-foot chunk of a building she and her husband bought in downtown Gilbert.
One of my things I want to have is a broadcast room and then really train women how to conduct webinars, go to meetings, those types of things, and have all the equipment and everything in there so that the technology part is taken care of for them.
For a lot of people in general, sort of going to work can be a drag. What do you think an effective workspace based on your experience can be and what should it look like? And how does that differ for women in the working world?
Our office is incredibly open, which leads to collaboration, which I really think is the way we need to work today to be effective. What we're missing in our current space that you also need to have then is quiet areas that you can go to when you really need to do focused work. How that is different for women, I think women are naturally very collaborative anyway, and so I think that fits right into what women are going to need. A lot of co-working spaces are pretty urban and almost masculine. We're certainly not going to have pink walls and flowers everywhere, but we're definitely going to have, you know, a feeling that is cool and calming, relaxing, so that you're not, you know, in a high stress feeling and you can come into a place that feels really comfortable.
What are some of the unique needs that women have, whether it's those who are still making the choice of whether to stay home with children or how often they would be home with children or whether they and a partner have a different sort of agreement? Can you talk about some of those challenges that still exist and maybe some of the disadvantages women can face in a more typical workspace?
Yeah, very glad you asked that. I really raised my children in that time where the lines were really clear and women weren't often supportive if you stayed home versus you were the mom that went out and worked, and it didn't seem like there was a lot of option in the middle. It was almost like a battlefield. You know, you had your stay-at-home moms on one side and you had your working moms on the other, and I think they both judged each other a bit harshly. Now it's become much more fluid. There's more flex time, those types of things. The opportunities, I think, are really better. As a result, though, you have a lot of women who are either trying to make it on their own, they're running a small business or a solo entrepreneurship type of business, I think the unique needs for women are that you have fear, anxiety, insecurity, those types of things that are just there because the workforce is still so predominantly male in almost every field.
If you were to say, after having people involved in this for a certain amount of time, are there certain qualities you want to see come out of that?
I think confidence is probably number one. The second thing, really, we're going to have an education component to this. I plan to have a baseline membership that even women who might be an executive at a bank and work at a large company can come into the space for networking opportunities with other women executives, other women in business. Overall, I want to see women really finding a way to achieve their highest level of whatever that is.
Lynn King-Smith of Ticketforce, the co-working space for women in Gilbert, is expected to be ready sometime in 2015.
Budgets can be kind of mind-numbing to look at, so a lot of people may not know where a government gets its money or how it spends that cash. The National Priorities Project is trying to change that. The nonpartisan group works to make the federal budget accessible to average citizens. It's launched a new website that breaks down how much federal money goes to each state. Lindsay Kashgarian, research director at National Priorities Project, says of the $3 trillion federal budget, Arizona gets about $68 billion.
But Arizona, like most states, gets the biggest chunk of that federal aid in assistance to individuals. And what that means is really Social Security, Medicare, also food stamps, unemployment, education assistance, things that actually where the government, federal government actually sends a check directly to an individual. And the biggest piece of that really is Social Security. So it really is, you know, the federal government sending grandma a check. And in Arizona, that's about $36 billion of the $68 billion total. So it's more than half.
And that's a big distinction you just made, because when you talk about $68 billion coming from the feds, the entire state budget is $9 billion. So obviously, there's a good amount of money that's not flowing through the state government that's going directly to residents here.
That's exactly right. There is a huge chunk of money that goes directly to residents. There are also chunks of money that go directly to Arizona businesses. So in Arizona, the second biggest chunk of federal dollars goes to contractors. So again, not flowing through the state government, but going directly to businesses in the state.
So where does Arizona fall in terms of the amount that other states get of federal money? Where does Arizona's $68 billion fall?
Well, taking that high-level number and comparing it among states, while you can do that, it's tricky because of things like Arizona is, you know, it's the 11th oldest state in the nation. So when you think about such a huge piece of this being Social Security, a lot of those are checks that are coming to Social Security recipients who are retirees. A lot of them, as you probably know, may or may not have always lived in Arizona. They may go there. So there's so many sort of factors like that in terms of what state gets how much money. You know, we really don't advise comparing the direct total among the states. These are really things that, you know, we invest in as a nation.
We hear so much about donor states. You know, a lot of people in a lot of different states complain about the amount of taxes they pay into Washington and what the state gets back for that. Where does Arizona fall in that regard?
Well, we don't really compare the total money out of Arizona and the total money into Arizona for a couple of reasons. One is that there are data reasons that make it tricky just to do that technically. But another reason being that a lot of these are really national priorities, and that's why they're federal government initiatives in the first place. I mean, that's easy to see in the case of something like defense, where, you know, we all pay in and we all expect to share the benefits from that. The fact that Arizona receives more contract dollars, you wouldn't necessarily want states to all get the same amount of federal contract dollars. You might prefer that the federal contracts go to the business that's best positioned to perform those contracts.
What do you hope that people who look at this website and maybe look at their state in particular will get from the data that you have there?
What I hope they'll get is just how much the federal government does in their very own communities. You know, I mean, the biggest piece of this being the federal aid to individuals, and that is a federal government function, and that is something that the federal government does in all of our communities, not in Washington, D.C. That's the message we're really trying to get across with this website, is the way that the government actually affects real people.
Lindsay Kashgarian is the research director for the group National Priorities Project. We'll link to the site at kjzz.org.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Isaac Caruso with Scarce Elements Crew. We are downtown doing a live painting. We are painting next to Mon Orchid, where I painted a mural on the exterior. It's just a girl's face with a lot of floral elements, and she's floating in space. It's just got a lot of urban art sensibility, very detailed, really, really nice piece. I've been going here since I was like 16, so seeing it grow, seeing the new artists, meeting people, getting myself out there as an artist, it's great fun.
That's Isaac Caruso doing a live street painting at Roosevelt Row in downtown Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just want to dip us in some paint, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
Just ahead, the Oakland A's are getting ready to move into their new spring training home, which the team thinks will provide an advantage over its old spring training home.
We have a lot of the newer amenities in the environment, the training facilities, the kitchens, and all those amenities that we did not have at our previous location will certainly help, yes.
That's ahead. It's the show.
So far, a relatively light Thursday afternoon as far as Valley traffic is concerned. No reports of heavy slowing, but do watch out for a couple of accidents. I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue, also I-17 southbound at Cactus. If you'd like the weather we've had for the last few days, it will remain the same, if just a touch warmer. Looking for a high temperature tomorrow of 96 degrees. Currently mostly sunny and 91 at 235.
KJZZ is supported by Perkins Coie's startup, Percolator, helping entrepreneurs access the legal counsel they need to succeed. Online at startupPercolator.com. Perkins Coie, counsel to great companies.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Authorities in Canada say the gunman involved in yesterday's attack in and around the Parliament building in Ottawa was acting alone, and there was no apparent link to an incident in Quebec earlier in the week. Each of those incidents left one Canadian soldier dead. The head of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Bob Paulson, says anticipating such attacks is not easy.
These are difficult threats to detect. There is no way of knowing where or when such an attack could take place.
Paulson confirms the attacker was 32-year-old Michael Zihoff Bibau, who had a criminal record and who was looking to travel to Syria. Canada's Parliament building was closed to the public today, but lawmakers returned, and they gave a standing ovation to the Sergeant-at-Arms, Kevin Vickers. His is usually a ceremonial role, but when he saw the gunman barge into the building yesterday, he retrieved a handgun from his office and shot at the attacker. He's being credited with saving many lives. Jack Harris, who's a member of Parliament, says he expects to see tighter security at the complex from now on.
There obviously was a vulnerability that this individual was able to penetrate. Clearly, that's not going to be allowed to happen again.
Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper is urging lawmakers to seek help if they're suffering from stress following the attack. The Pentagon says Iraq's new defense minister is pledging that his troops will go on the offensive against so-called Islamic State militants who now control a large swath of that country. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel spoke by phone today with his new Iraqi counterpart, Khalid al-Obeidi. Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby says al-Obeidi pledged to reform Iraq's army.
In fact, he used the word reform in terms of what he knows he needs to do with the Iraqi army. There's institutional reforms that he knows he has to make.
Kirby says Hagel says he'll work with Iraq's military to ensure the troops are well trained and equipped there. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Gund Foundation, working to advance Cleveland and Northeast Ohio, at gundfoundation.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Is the United States preparing for a conflict with China? And if so, why? Recently in the Western Pacific, the U.S. Navy and Air Force carried out their largest combined exercise in nearly 10 years.
Two carrier battle groups and 200 aircraft took part. The American military will not say so openly, but the aim was to prepare U.S. forces for a limited war in the East or South China Seas. The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes was one of a handful of journalists allowed aboard to watch.
So we're now on final approach. We're heading down to land on board the USS George Washington, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. When we do land, it will be an arrested landing. So when we hit the deck, we will go from about 150 miles an hour to zero in about 2 seconds. It's a pretty brutal landing.
Once we get close to the ship, you're going to feel the plane going up, down, left, right. Little sharp movements. That's normal. Perfectly normal. You'll see myself, Petty Officer Miller, wave our hands in the air, say, here we go, here we go. Just a few seconds before we actually touch down on the ship.
Go! Go!
Okay, that's the signal. So here we go. And we're down. That's more like a controlled crash.
Welcome aboard the USS George Washington. We're out in the Pacific Ocean, somewhere off the coast of Guam. And we've come out here to see what is the largest combined naval and air exercise in nearly 10 years. There is the USS George Washington carrier battle group, there is the USS Carl Vinson carrier battle group, and there are more than 200 Navy and Air Force planes taking part in this enormous exercise.
About 400 mile and a half.
Well, we've just seen 11 aircraft launched from the deck of the George Washington, and now we're watching 11 more being brought back on board. The last one just about to land behind me here. This really is an extraordinary sight. Only the US Navy can do this. No one will say it openly, but this is about practicing for conflict with China.
Having flown them a little bit and watched how challenging it is to trap, launch and trap off an aircraft carrier.
The man in command of this huge operation is Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery.
The U.S. Navy is one of the single greatest contributors to the security and stability of the Asia-Pacific region. We have been for nearly 70 years, and I think that the U.S. Navy plays a good role, whether it's in the South China Sea, East China Sea, stabilizing things, assuring our partners, and dissuading any adversaries from taking actions that are non-transparent or illegal.
That's a polite way of saying that the U.S. will not sit back and watch Beijing turn the East and South China Seas into Chinese lakes. But he admits it is an increasingly complex task. Beijing is deploying all sorts of new weapons designed specifically to keep America's carrier battle groups far away from China's shores.
When we talk about our capabilities, we're talking about our capabilities to operate in a generally unrestricted way in the waters of our choice. As some countries have increasingly complex anti-access or area denial weapons, we have to develop our tactics, techniques, and procedures to continue to operate in an unfettered manner.
Black smoke reporting in compartment 1, tag 245, tag 7, Quebec. Aviation hydraulic.
As if on cue, the George Washington comes under simulated attack.
This is a drill.
Part of the ship is reported to be on fire. Crews rush to contain the damage.
Aviation hydraulic pneumatic shop.
For the last 10 years, China's leaders have insisted that its rise to superpower status will be peaceful. And America has responded by insisting it wants to engage with China, not contain it. But out here in the Pacific, there is a distinct feeling that the mood is changing, that China is starting to flex its new military muscle, and that America has no choice but to respond.
The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes reporting from onboard the USS George Washington in the Pacific Ocean.
The Have you ever had a buddy whose chest puffed out as he told you about how his favorite car, the first new one he ever bought, had just hit 200,000 miles on the odometer?
If so, Tom Gamache's 1972 Chevy Blazer might cut him down to size. It's reached 1.5 million miles.
Matt Jaffe wrote about the truck and the road trips he and Gamache have taken in it in the November issue of Arizona Highways.
I'm not actually a car guy. Tom Gamache is a good friend of mine. He's a landscape photographer, and we've traveled together for more than 20 years in his 1972 Chevy Blazer. The Blazer has 1.5 million miles on it, and Tom still uses it as his heavy-duty work vehicle. It's by no means is it a museum piece. This is the vehicle that he takes off on dirt roads and some really very dodgy roads in the Southwest and other areas. And it's really a remarkable truck because it just does things that modern trucks can't do in quite the same way.
And everyone gets excited, and I would think for good reason when they hear, oh, a car got up to 250,000 miles. We're talking about over 1 million miles. First of all, has Tom done anything special with this truck to keep it so sturdy? And secondly, is there something, I don't want to say spiritually different, but is there something that is different inherently about riding in a vehicle that has been through so much and that it really feels like it's bonded with its owner?
I think because Tom has some real skills working on vehicles, he's made a few enhancements, which, frankly, I don't fully understand in terms of the overdrive. And it is a different experience traveling in a truck like this because it has such a personal history for Tom, but also now for me. And I also think that when you're in an older vehicle like this without air conditioning, there's an AM radio that in the time that I've been traveling with Tom has never worked. And you really do get a sense of the elements a bit more. I think a lot of modern vehicles, as comfortable as they are, tend to feel rather sealed up. And when you get out into the Southwest and Red Rock Country, I think that there is something special about feeling the road, and which isn't to say that the Blazer isn't a comfortable ride, but it just doesn't ride the same way as a vehicle that came out in 2014 might feel.
Matt, for people who have only been in Arizona for a short time or have been around but have never driven through some of the areas you describe, Navajo Nation is a unique place. Can you describe what some of the sights are like and what it's like to be in that truck in that area of the Southwest?
It can almost feel like you're at sea. Not that there's nothing there, but it's big and it's open and it has this really epic quality to it. Tom grew up in New Hampshire. I grew up in Chicago. And it really embodies what my sense of what the Southwest was supposed to be. And it's really a great feeling to be able to escape into a landscape like that, even now. Like anything else, it's changed, but you do have a sense of timelessness that you don't often have in a lot of places.
The road trip, whether it's in a unique vehicle like this one or not, seems such at the heart of America. Do you and Tom have that feeling in the road trips you've made?
One of the things that Tom and I sometimes talk about is how intimate a road trip is, because the windshield frames the landscape, and it's intimate in the sense that you're not usually looking at each other, you're just looking out at the landscape. So it's almost that feeling that you sometimes have if you're camping with somebody and it's dark and you're in the tent and you're talking and you're not necessarily looking directly at somebody, and it's this very direct connection with somebody else's mind and their thoughts.
Matt Jaffe, who wrote about a 72 Chevy Blazer with 1.5 million miles for November's Arizona Highways. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. It is a Thursday. Yeah, that's going to be a thing going forward, Thursdays and Fridays for the show with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic at this hour. Accidents, I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue. Also, the 60 eastbound at Mill. The shoulder is blocked. Sky is expected to be clear tonight around the valley with overnight lows in the mid to upper 60s. Sunny, a little bit warmer tomorrow with a high near 96. Currently, we've got clear skies and 91 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Healthcare Primary Care and John C. Lincoln Physician Network. During your benefits open enrollment period, you can find the right primary care doctor for your needs at rightdocforme.com.
The World Series and the Arizona Fall League are both underway, but some Valley baseball fans are already looking ahead to spring training. And if you're an Oakland A's fan, you've got a new spring home to look forward to.
So you're standing at Hohokam Stadium, originally built in 1997. Shuttered in 2013 to begin the renovation for the Oakland Athletics in their partnership with the City of Mesa.
Jason Boyer with the firm Gensler led a tour of the construction site at Hohokam and Fitch Park just down the street. You may remember the Chicago Cubs used to train there, but they moved a few miles away to Riverview Park before this year's Cactus League. Oakland A's president Michael Crowley says the new facilities will help the team.
I think anytime you're trying to recruit free agents, especially, the facilities that you have, whether it be at the minor league or spring training level or at the major league level, is critical. I mean, it's, you know, there are a lot of things that come into play, obviously salary and other things, but not only to have nice facilities, but to be in an area that's desirable, and certainly the Cactus League is desirable.
There is a bit of history here. The A's trained in Mesa from 1969 to 78 and won the World Series in 1972, 73, and 74. Mayor John Giles says he watched Reggie Jackson and Raleigh Fingers, among others, play in his hometown during that time. The team had trained at Phoenix Muni since 1982. A's president Michael Crowley says the new digs will be better than the old ones.
We have a lot of the newer amenities in the environment, the training facilities, the kitchens, and all those amenities that we did not have at our previous location will certainly help, yes.
Those amenities include a new scoreboard, renovated training facilities, fields, locker rooms, and offices, among other things. A's owner Lou Wolf is excited about the changes.
This is not a rehabilitation. As you walk through, you'll see this is pretty much new construction, and certainly it is with the wonderful fields here.
The A's and Mesa signed a 20-year deal in March of last year for the team to come back to Mesa starting this spring. The overall cost of rehab and new construction is nearly $27 million, with Mesa paying a maximum $17.5 million. Mayor John Giles says it's a good deal for the city.
I'm excited that we can, for a lot of great financial reasons, we can defend this absolutely to any one that wants to question the economic wisdom of it. But to me, almost more importantly than that, is just the quality of life and the spirit, the things that it gives our community to do.
The team will start moving into their new digs in a couple of months, and there's still a bunch of work to do before that. The A's lost in the wild card game this year, but team officials say they're confident they'll make it farther with their new spring training home.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Singer-songwriter Glenn Campbell lived in Arizona for about 20 years. He was part of our collective growing up in the 1960s.
The songs Wichita Lineman, Gentle on My Mind, Rhinestone Cowboy, Classical Gas, I could never really tell if he was just a country boy, some political revolutionary making controversial establishment challenging television with the Smothers Brothers, or just a fantastic musician. He was all of those. Memories I still have. But Glenn Campbell doesn't have those memories anymore.
I'm still here, but yet I'm gone. I don't play guitar or sing my song.
And the first time I heard it, I thought, oh, gosh, that's so sad. Then I listened to it, and Jillian said, no, it's the opposite.
The man that loved you till the end.
It's a celebration. He's telling Kim he's going to be okay.
You're the last person I will love.
That's James Keach, who has documented Campbell's heroic and tragic slide into Alzheimer's disease in the new film, Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me. It's the story of Campbell's last tour, his decline, and his love for his wife, Kim. Kim Campbell and James Keach say this movie is all about the power of memory and music, and how music, in a sense, wins.
I think Glenn understood how fortunate and how unfortunate some of the things that he had done were. In fact, a lot of times he would often talk about the years of drugs and how he regretted it and how he regretted what it did to Kim, especially the drinking part of his life. And I think what we later discovered was is that was actually the beginning of his Alzheimer's, and he was trying to self-medicate because he was so agitated and confused about things. But he was a guy who we would call him the Buddha, because in his Alzheimer's state, he would repeat certain things. And these things were so important to him, like always tell the truth. And when a man findeth a good woman, he findeth a good thing. And then he'd point over to Kim, I found me a good thing. And it's better to laugh than to cry. Just he would say these things, and he would talk about drugs as if the devil himself put those in his hand. Without proselytizing, he was a very deep man of faith.
I think this movie portrays the cost of the devastating loss of Alzheimer's in a way that's really different from so many, because we all have the memories of Glenn Campbell that he no longer has. How did you feel about seeing his memory of this spectacular life, even with the setbacks, beginning to slip away, Kim?
It is tragic. It's so sad. I mean, I sense that when I watched the film today. It's the only way I can share memories with him now is by watching film. But he doesn't have any memories anymore, really. But he does know who I am. You know, he lights up when I come into the room, and he knows I'm his wife, and he knows that he loves me. So he remembers feelings rather than specific memories.
Well, thank goodness someone was rolling a camera at some of those moments. The opening is just as you describe, him watching some family movies. Here's a clip from that scene.
Who's that?
That's your third wife, Sarah, and Dylan. And then you met me.
Wow, she's a good-looking girl, and she still is.
This is a medical story. Glenn is in a situation where he can get the best possible care. How did you decide to document that?
We decided to document it just by going there and being with him. Mm-hmm. I mean, Glenn was aware of what we were doing.
Right.
When the doctors realized it was okay, the patient was okay with this, they revealed the gnarly truth.
Yeah. So if we look at these bottom pictures here, the ones that have the blue background, if the brain pattern was normal, it would be solid dark blue, like this color in here.
Yeah.
And so things in that part of the brain are not working quite normally. This indicates that in all likelihood, your difficulties are due to Alzheimer's disease.
It's a pretty tough sentence to tell somebody they have Alzheimer's. So we went to the Mayo Clinic in that sequence, and he accepted the hand that he'd been dealt. And the one thing that was very common about Glenn, and is very common in the film, is the laughter. Glenn was always cracking jokes.
It's nothing wrong with me, I just can't remember anything.
And he would make light of it. And so, you know, it's like people talking to people with a paralysis
right.
in the third person. What does he want? You know, so in Glenn's case, they don't want to talk about he's got Alzheimer's. Everybody kind of knows it, so they won't say it. And I'd say very loudly, so Glenn, how's the Alzheimer's? And everybody would turn and go, you're not supposed to do that. And I said, no, that's exactly what I'm supposed to do.
What was his answer?
I have part-timers. Or, what's Alzheimer's? Or, it's fine. It's what it is. Or, you know, and then I'd say, what's it like to lose your memory? And he goes, it sucks. It sucks. And then he'd start laughing about things he'd forgotten, and he'd get us laughing about it, and then it made everything okay.
How's the Alzheimer's, Kim?
Well, it's definitely progressed. I think when we were doing the film, he was going through stages 2, 3, and 4, and then, you know, for the past year and a half, he's entered stage 5, and now he's in stage 6. And so in stage 6, he's lost most of his ability to communicate. He can still speak, you know, small sentences like I love you. That's the most important thing. He can't understand anything I say to him. So it's really hard to communicate. He loves to laugh. In fact, he will make a nonsensical sentence and then just laugh and laugh and laugh like he's made a joke. And then it just cracks up. So we start laughing with him, and that just brings him a lot of joy because he loves to entertain and he loves to make people laugh.
Yeah.
Let's listen to one moment from on stage here, and I just want to get your recollections of what was going on in this part of the film.
You haven't introduced everybody now?
Yeah, we're going to do that later. We're going to introduce the band later.
Okay, thank you, darling.
How about we duel a little bit?
Dueling.
Yeah.
You only do.
All right.
Okay.
You ready?
Of course, I was born ready.
That was at the Ryman.
Yeah.
That was at the Ryman show. And just prior to that, the teleprompter had gone bad, and the whole show stopped. It was in the first song. He's standing there, and he's going, where, what? His musical director says, the teleprompter just broke down. We'll get it back up again. And Ashley's going, Dad, it's okay. And he just sitting there, and he's fine with the whole thing. And he says, are we back? Is it coming back? Yeah, we're back. And there it goes. And then he just took off.
How precious is it to have all these moments recorded on film and as a part of this project, that when the tour and all the promotion for the film is gone, this will be something that you have and your family has? How important and precious is it?
We are extremely grateful to have it, and we will cherish it forever. It was the best time of our life.
Well, thank you so much for sharing it with all of us. Kim Campbell, wife of Glenn Campbell, and James Keach, director and producer of Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The documentary opens in theaters on Friday.
I'm never gonna hold you like I did. I say I love you to the kids.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
This has been The Show on KJZZ, a stream of curated stories from Phoenix and the Valley, our region, and stories from around the country and across the world. With the help of reporters and producers around the region and the globe, we'll mix the stories and news to keep you up to date and entertained both on Thursdays and on Fridays.
That's right. We'll be back at it again tomorrow afternoon at 2. ADOT has started sending letters to homeowners who'd be affected by the proposed South Mountain Freeway and the future of Phoenix's second oldest building. We'll have a lot more as well on the show tomorrow afternoon at 2.
The show was produced this week by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nick Blumberg, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is up next on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. Have a great afternoon. It's 3 o'clock.